on 2FM with Green Farm. Get real with Green Farm's chicken and turkey range. Real protein, real tasty. Game on, weeknights from 6 on 2FM.
Yes, a big thank you to Laura Fox for kicking things off this week in perfect entertaining fashion. It's Monday the 28th of February. You're listening to Game On. Coming up this evening, Alan Colley and Fergal Brennan are standing by to talk FIFA, Abramovich, Bielsa, League of Ireland and of course, Quivin.
This is the moment that the goalkeepers some like, some hate. Kelleher and Kepa. Stay calm. You've been brilliant in goal. One solid kick. Brilliant.
Get in.
Good lad.
Well done.
And so the man who came on to be Chelsea's hero now has to keep Chelsea in the cup final. And if he does, we start again. It's Kepa. Oh, he's missed. And it's Liverpool's League Cup once again.
I doubt that was something he thought would happen to him when he woke up yesterday morning. But anyway, in rugby, Murray Kinsella will tell us if Ireland learned anything from yesterday's mismatch against the Italians. The two captains most certainly learned a few new rules. And in Gaelic football, we'll have Barry Cahill on Kildare's victory over Kildare. Yes, Kildare's victory over Dublin.
Game on 2FM.
Yes, it is great to have your company in this Monday evening. As always, if you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM. And we have a packed studio to answer any questions that come in via Twitter or indeed via the text line. Alan Colley, Murray Kinsella, both present. I'm Shane Dawson, and you heard the dulcet tones of Ruby Walsh just a moment ago. Lads, before we, I suppose, look ahead, and we want to get into the conversation about, I suppose, the very serious conversation about Russia's response to, or sports response, I should say, to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But before we do, kind of looking back on the highlights from the weekend, Ruby Walsh, if I come to you first, you got very giddy, very excited there, talking about Kildare's victory over Dublin. Perhaps, I suspect, that might be one of your sporting highlights from last weekend?
I'm not really sure how the saying goes, but I'm going to, you know, make my own interpretation of it. But what sells them is beautiful, Shane. And I mean, if you're a Kildare man on the border of Dublin, 20 years waiting to beat the Dubs, it doesn't bother us that it's the league and it's February. We still beat the Dubs. And that's a big thing. I rang William McCreary this morning to slag him. He's about the only fella that played in 96 that wasn't on the sideline yesterday. I see Charlie McCreevy was even on the sideline for Kildare yesterday. But yeah, look, it was great. And Newbridge won 12 to 12 points. It was magic. And, you know, Dublin have made it 4 in a row. It'll be interesting to see how they get on the next day now. They'll make it 5 in a row. Yeah. Losses, that is.
I know. Murray Kinsella, your sporting highlight from the weekend?
Yeah, Ireland match didn't quite work out as we expected. Certainly not what anyone expected. The contest was kind of destroyed after 19 minutes, but some nice individual performance in there. Mike Lowry scoring 2 tries in his debut was hard not to be really pleased for him. Massive smile across his face and some nice moments with his family. So, yeah, there was nice individual bits in a disappointing game overall.
Alan, I suppose it has to be the League of Ireland for you. Which game was it?
It does, Ruby. I was in the Brandywell on Friday night, and I suppose this year the narrative before the league kicked off a couple of weeks back was obviously Shamrock Rovers are trying to defend their title, but the nearest challengers that all the pundits or people reckon maybe Derry City. So they actually obviously met on Friday night, so the second game of the season, and for them to go head to head, it was a good, I suppose, evening to find out just how far Derry City are away from Shamrock Rovers, and they matched them all over the pitch the whole night. They competed ever so well, I thought, anyway, on the evening. It wasn't a great game in terms of as a spectacle because of the weather conditions, but Jamie McGonigal, a young player from up that area, popped up in the 95th minute, and there's no better time to score than the last kick of the game. An unbelievable finish as well for him. So it certainly, I suppose it was kind of just in terms of where we're all at with the league and where we think it may go. It was good as well that we saw Derry beating them, because I know Shamrock Rovers are a very good side and they've won it the last 2 years, and I don't mean this kind of disrespectfully towards them, but we do want to see some sort of a challenge from other teams this year. So for Derry to get the win and give them a massive boost of confidence going into the game tonight as well, it was a great moment as well and a great goal. And I have to give a mention to Quivin Kelleher as well yesterday. I know we'll probably get on to that later on, but I'm just mad about this lad. Just, I suppose the biggest thing for me, everybody can see his talent and just how good he is and the level that he's playing at and the standard in terms of the football club that he's at. But just his demeanour and the way he carries himself and how he conducts himself, I think he's absolutely fantastic. And I'd say it's not going to be long before he's banging on the door in terms of becoming the number one. And I'm sure Alisson is feeling that as well. The narrative around him as well was that he should move and go somewhere else and play regularly. But I never understood that kind of mindset from people, because he's at one of the biggest clubs in the world under one of the best managers in the world. He's playing regular enough in terms of the cup competitions and developing all the time. So it was a great day for him yesterday,
and he has a winner's medal to boot. But guys, there were the highlights. It's about news as well. And Shane, FIFA and UEFA have suspended Russian clubs and national teams from all competitions this afternoon.
Yes, they have indeed, Ruby. Actually, they just released a statement just before we came on air that says, following the initial decisions adopted by the FIFA Council and UEFA Executive Committee, which envisaged the adoption of additional measures, FIFA and UEFA have today decided together that all Russian teams, whether national representative teams or club teams, shall be suspended from participation in both FIFA and UEFA competitions until further notice. These decisions were adopted today by the Bureau of the FIFA Council and the Executive Committee of UEFA, respectively, the highest decision-making bodies of both institutions on such urgent matters. Football is fully united here and in full solidarity with all of the people affected in Ukraine. Both presidents hope that the situation in Ukraine will improve significantly and rapidly so that football can again be a vector for unity and peace amongst people. Alan, I don't mean to be crass, but it's about time.
Absolutely, Shane. That was my initial reaction. It's a really strong statement, but why is it only coming out now? I felt it was really disrespectful towards, I suppose, even the Polish players having to make their own decisions on this last week. And they were almost making a decision. And then, obviously, there was a lot of chat around other teams and our own country included. Obviously, we have to play in the Nations League against Ukraine and games coming up as well. And I think the decision should have been taken out of all the federation's hands and coming from the very highest level, and that's where it's come from today. It's the right decision, and as you say, why has it taken so long?
I know the argument with the IOC, and they have followed similar path, is that athletes aren't necessarily involved and no one wants to deprive them due right to participate or play or take part, but that to me misses the point. I don't know what you think, Alan, but you might be penalising participants and not by not allowing them to partake, but it most certainly penalises the country and therefore could create angst with it, with the people of a country. So therefore it has to happen.
Yeah, I would think so as well, Ruby, because I do have a little bit of sympathy for the individual participants, because as you said, well, we hope, and obviously they're not involved and they have lives to live as well, and they're being affected by this. But I think it's far bigger than that, and the decision had to have been taken out of their hands as well, because it's just as we've all seen, and obviously we're looking on from afar, but as we've all seen over the last few days, it's really hard to comprehend just how those people must be feeling. And there's no way, look, sport unites us all in every level of sport, but there was no way that I felt that any of the federations across any sport could stand by and let other countries or other teams make decisions not to play against Russia. It had to be taken out of those federations' hands, as I said, and the decision coming from the very highest level that it could come from, which is what we've seen today finally.
Just to continue myself reading out statements, the FAI also released a statement today announcing they will play no fixtures at any level against Russia due to the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. In a statement, the organisation offered their unequivocal support to the Ukraine FA and confirmed that the Aviva Stadium will be lit up in yellow and blue, the colours of the Ukrainian flag, at 7 p.m. tonight.
Alan, there was hardly any Irish teams due to play a Russian team shortly, was there?
Not that I'm aware of, no, because obviously they're not in European competition. But I think it's just we have to stand in solidarity with Ukraine here, Ruby. And like, there was different things happening over the weekend in terms of protests, and sometimes you think in these situations, what could we do? And there's probably very little in terms of what we can do individually to make a difference. But I think in terms of governing bodies across the board, across Europe, wherever it may be, we have to stand and be seen to be standing in solidarity with Ukraine at this moment in time. You obviously seen the scenes yesterday, Saturday evening, first of all, with the Everton Man City match and the players involved, Zinchenko and Mykolenko of West Ham. And it's so sad. And as I said, we can't comprehend for 1 second what they must be going through, or trying to get in touch with family members back home in Ukraine as well. So it's the right decision. It was the only decision, as Shane alluded to in his intro. Why has it taken so long? But it's absolutely the right decision.
Just, I suppose, other sporting organisations as well. Badminton's world governing body responded to Russia's invasion by announcing the cancellation of all tournaments in Russia and Belarus, in addition to banning the national flags and anthems of the two nations. The Ukrainian Tennis Federation has called the sports governing body, the International Tennis Federation, to expel Russia and Belarus from the organisation and ban Russia from individual and team tournaments. Russia's Daniil Medvedev, who became the ATP's world number one Monday, said he wanted to promote peace all over the world in a news conference on Friday during the Mexican opening. Fencing in the World Cup in Cairo on Sunday, Ukraine's men's foil team refused to fence against Russia as well. And Murray Kinsella, you had a story on the 42.ie today about the Ukrainian Rugby Federation, who've written to World Rugby and Rugby Europe urging them to ban Russian teams from all international rugby competitions.
Yeah, it's obviously a different profile. Ukraine are in the third tier, European rugby, Russia in the second tier. But I don't think a lot of people know that actually the Russian women's national team played a match on Saturday in Madrid against Spain. It actually went ahead. World Rugby and Rugby Europe suspended matches in Russia, not Russian teams. So they're currently meeting at the moment, and I'd be shocked if they don't follow suit with those other sporting bodies. It was a surprise to me that that Russian team played in Madrid, given what's going on. As I say, it was very low profile, but it just didn't sit right.
Obviously, there is massive Russian involvement in the Premier League with Roman Abramovich's involvement in Chelsea. We did learn at the weekend that the stewardship and care has been handed to the trustees of Chelsea's charitable foundation. Roman Abramovich has lent Chelsea Football Club $1.5 billion. Fergal Brennan joins us on the line. Fergal, this is probably a very technical question. Is there a chance that sanctions being imposed on Russia could somehow be imposed on Chelsea Football Club?
I think the potential for that, or concern over that, is one of the primary motivations for Abramovich making this statement. In terms of the legal side of it, I think all of us have probably had to go away and do a bit of research on this. But effectively, stewardship and care is a bit of a placeholder position. And the club's charitable foundation, the trustees that run that, have not actually accepted Abramovich's offer to pass over control to them. So effectively, this is a safeguarding move that's been made personally by Abramovich. Depending on which way you want to look at it, I would kind of take a little bit more of a cynical line and say that there is a concern that as one of his assets, some parts of the operation of Chelsea Football Club, not the entire entity in terms of it being floated on the stock market, could be frozen, or certain aspects could be restricted. That's what he wants to guard against. There's been some kind of narrative around it saying that it's a selfless move and that he wants to protect the club. I don't really see it that way. I think he's trying to get ahead of the game in terms of his approach to the situation. And effectively, this idea that it's an enormous move and a sea change in terms of the day-to-day running and financial operations of Chelsea Football Club, as it stands, and certainly in the short term between now and the end of the season, very little will change. He's still the owner. He's still the figurehead of the club. The amount of money that he's ploughed in since 2003 when he took over is absolutely eye-watering. And yes, you've mentioned the figure that he's loaned the club. Currently, if they were to be sold, according to sources in the United States this morning, it's worth about $2.2 billion. So if somebody was to come in and buy it or potentially make an offer, it'd be the most expensive club purchase in history. To put it into a bit of context, Newcastle was recently bought out for about $350 million. I know all this sounds absolutely mad. None of us have this amount of money. But when we're talking in the grand scheme of things, $2.2 billion in comparison to $350 million is an enormous difference. And when you're dealing with those amounts of figures, that demonstrates that very little is going to change at Chelsea unless sanctions start to impose on Abramovich directly, which, as it stands, doesn't look to be happening.
When you look at the Premier League then, Fergal, and you look at Man City being privately owned, Newcastle, as you just said there, recently bought, could this be a little bit worrying for the Premier League in their actual structure, the way their clubs are owned by almost foreign states?
Effectively, yes, but I think we're still in a situation whereby the safeguards that the Premier League put in place, the fit and proper persons test that they require owners to go through, and the checks that they make are very, very, very basic. And this controversy surrounding ownership and surrounding the sources of money, or rather the lack of information about the sources of money that fund these bodies, and as you say, states that effectively own the majority of the big names in Premier League football, until the standards are raised and until the safeguards and the checks that are put in place by the Premier League are massively tightened up, I don't think it's going to necessarily change, because Newcastle have kind of set a standard whereby there was this widespread objection, justified widespread objection to them taking over. And the Premier League just rode the storm for 6 to 8 weeks, let it die down. The January transfer window came in. Because Newcastle didn't make any massive signings, there wasn't a huge amount of spotlight being thrown on them. And that's effectively the case. I would like to see a massive amount more scrutiny placed on these states, bodies, individuals that are invested in Premier League football, because it sets a really dangerous precedent in terms of what's creeping into football, not just in the Premier League, across the wider European picture. But no, I don't have a massive amount of confidence that it'll lead to a huge amount of change, because as it stands, the Premier League are not massively interested in change.
Well, look, that's an ever-evolving picture that we will keep an eye on. But if we turn our attention back to yesterday, Chelsea's luck just really isn't in, is it, Fergal? 3 disallowed goals and then they lose 11-10 on penalties.
Yeah, it was a hell of a game, for a game that finished 0-0 after 90 and then after 120 minutes. It was one of the best 0-0s I've watched in a long time. But there was a little bit of that at both ends. The Virgil van Dijk goal that was ruled out was, I think, just a leg or half a leg offside. So all of the VAR calls, or even the offside calls that were made at both ends, were really, really tight. I actually think the referee did a really good job in terms of managing the flow of the game. There was a few pretty dicey challenges in the first half that he let go with a warning, which is really good, sensible, professional refereeing. But in terms of the ending, it was absolutely fantastic. Well, unless you're a Chelsea fan. But I just think in terms of the way Chelsea managed the game, the decision to bring Kepa on, I don't like those type of calls. But unless you've got someone that is a stone-cold specialist at saving penalties, Kepa has an okay record at saving penalties, either in normal time or in penalty shootouts. He's not a specialist. He's not a veteran keeper that will come on and look to upset the opposition. I mean, you look at some of the spot kicks that were taken by Liverpool. He was trying to dance around and play mind games. The Van Dijk penalty, he tried to stand to one side and Van Dijk just batted it past him. I think it was a really bad call by Tuchel. So if there was maybe a couple of controversial ones for Chelsea, ultimately their manager and their substitute goalkeeper just weren't up to it in the parts of the game where Jurgen Klopp absolutely excelled. His game management was brilliant. He got pretty much every decision right. But the main decision, as Alan mentioned in the intro, was Kelleher. Right from the start, right the way through the 90 minutes, 120 minutes, penalties, he was absolutely fantastic. And just the penalty that he took said everything about him. 89,000 people at Wembley Stadium. He didn't even blink, steps up, sends his opposite number the wrong way and wins it for Liverpool. And then in his post-game saying that he hadn't even realised he'd scored the winning penalty. I think that says everything about Kelleher and hopefully the future career that's going to come for him.
Yeah, Alan, I suppose continuing the conversation about Queevy and Kelleher, such a wise, experienced, seemingly man, and he's only so young as well. I do want to ask you a question, because Jurgen Klopp came out and said he's the best number two in the world. Now, I'm sorry, but yes, it was absolutely fantastic and it was brilliant to see Queevin go so well, but would you go as far as saying that? Because I have in my head Keylor Navas, Gallini, Dean Henderson even. He's better than Dean Henderson?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Well, right now at this moment in time, I think he's proven that. Potentially, I think he will be better. But right now at this moment in time, if you were judging it, I thought you were going to ask me more so, rather than comparing him to the other number twos, I thought you were going to say, do you think he's a number one now? He's at the stage with the performances and what he's produced, every opportunity that he's been given. He's never let the club down. Klopp has full faith in him, full belief in him, never shirks any opportunity to play him. He obviously, in the build-up to this, the suggestion was, it's a cup final, will you change your goalkeeper? And he was adamant, no, Queevin's played in all the games up to now, he's more or less got us here, he will play in the final. And I firmly believe the talent is there. The talent is not in question, because he wouldn't be at the club if he wasn't there, or he wouldn't be playing at that level. The thing that separates him from me for being so young is his mentality and how he conducts himself. And you see that, Fergal alluded to the penalty being not even blinking. Nothing seems to faze him, Shane. And I really, like, as I said in earlier on when I was chatting about it, a lot of people I see on Twitter or different discussions that break around the Irish goalkeepers at the moment, because obviously we're so fortunate to have two or three really good ones. And because Bazunu was out, playing every week, and obviously a lot of focus on him if he does something good, whereas Kelleher might miss out 2 or 3 weeks or whatever, and everybody suggests, no, he needs to go and play, he needs to play regularly. I don't believe that for 1 second, Shane. He is playing, it's like the Phil Foden situation at Man City. I would compare it like obviously different positions, but like for like, when everybody was calling for Foden to go on loan, Phil Foden was playing then with the best players in the world under the best manager in the world, and look at his development in that 18 months 2 years, regular now, one of the best players. I think Kelleher in 18 months 2 years, it wouldn't surprise me in the slightest. I think Alisson is a brilliant goalkeeper and he's done amazing things since Liverpool has come in, but Klopp is in such a brilliant position, not only to have Alisson but to have Quevin Kelleher knocking on his door every day of the week or putting pressure on Alisson. It's brilliant for him as well in terms of keeping his game at such a level. So absolutely no way whatsoever. I think in 18 months it wouldn't surprise me if you see him being the number one, and that number two talk will be long gone, Shane.
So Fergal, when Keevan sits down this morning, or not this morning, probably at some stage next week when he comes down off a high to review this game, do you think he'll look at the Rudiger penalty or the Werner ones and think, I could have stopped those?
Potentially. I mean, he said that in his post-game interview, where he said he kind of would have preferred to save a couple of penalties rather than score it. Obviously, scoring it won the final, but you don't expect in a million years a keeper to be stepping up and taking a penalty, let alone a winning one. I just think, again, this feeds back into what Alan was saying about the mentality of him. That's what he's interested in, and that's the single-minded attitude you need to have to be an elite-level goalkeeper. He's standing there being interviewed after winning his first major trophy as a starter in the final, and his focus was on not necessarily the mistakes that he made, but the little improvements that he could have made in the game. That's something that when he goes back to training this week, Jurgen Klopp will probably speak to him about and say, yes, that's the standard that I expect you to be kept with. I would agree with what Alan was saying about him in terms of his future. I do agree, and I think Foden's a good comparison, this idea that when you're working with Guardiola at City or Klopp at Liverpool, you are in the best environment in world football, probably, for your development. The only difference, really, which will probably come down to Kelleher's own decision on his future, is when you're an outfield player, it is different. Phil Foden can get brought on for 10 or 15 minutes here and there. Phil Foden can play wide left, he can play wide right, he can play in cup games, he can play in certain European games. That allowed him to get a feel for it. Unfortunately, the situation for Kelleher, just simply because he's a goalkeeper, isn't that kind. He's probably not going to start a Premier League game unless Alisson is injured or suspended. He's probably not going to start a Champions League game unless that's the case either. That's the only slight caveat to all of this, because he is a goalkeeper. If he played on any other position in the pitch, I'd have no doubt in the world that he's in the best place where he is right now, developing and learning under Klopp and under Alisson. But that is going to creep into it in the next year, 18 months. I do agree with Alan that he's got a shot for the number one jersey, but Alisson is only 29. We're seeing a situation now where goalkeepers can play probably post 35 at the top level. Buffon's just signed a contract with extension with Parma this morning to play into his mid-40s. So that's a decision that Kelleher's going to make, because he will get game time. Klopp loves him, the club love him, the fans love him, but there is going to be a big call to be made on his part a little bit further down the line. But for now, he's absolutely in the right place.
Alan, I saw a friend of the show, Conan Byrne, pose a question on Twitter. Would you rather be Quevin Kelleher, have the League Cup success and play in that competition? And listen, he's got some game time in the Champions League as well. Or would you rather be Gavin Bazunu playing week in, week out regularly as a number one at senior level? And indeed, not even bringing into the conversation Mark Travers, who again is playing regular football as well. Or on the absolute flip of that, instead of turning this into a Messi v Ronaldo, can we all not just bask in the glory of having really good goalkeepers?
Well, it's all hypothetical, so what's the point in even having that conversation, honestly, Shane?
Because we're a sports show, Alan.
No,
understand. We're trying to continue a conversation.
Yeah, but I totally understand where it's different situations for all the keepers. Gavin Bazunu obviously got the opportunity to go out on loan. He's obviously flourishing in that position, and good luck to the kid. But that's the route and the path that he has taken. We all take different paths, different routes. Who's to say one is the right one, one is the wrong one? But if you look at the three goalkeepers and how they're going about their careers up to date, I would say they're all winning, every one of them. Bazunu is doing his way and he's playing every week. Travers is doing very well at Bournemouth. Obviously, Kelleher is in a different situation because he's not playing regularly every week. But I still think he's getting enough game time. But the difference with Kelleher, he's at a club, like Travers is at Bournemouth, completely lesser level, and Bazunu is obviously at Portsmouth, completely lesser level. So he's training with the best players in the world every day of the week, Kelleher. So could you compare that to maybe rather than playing in League One every week. I'm training with the best players in the world every day. So there are different arguments for everything, but I just think the biggest winner in all this is us as Irish fans and people and Stephen Kenny, because to have three as good as we have at the moment, but I think he's the best. I know Bazunu is getting all the praise, and rightly so. He's done amazing things since he's come into the Irish setup and since he's become number one, but potentially I think this fella is absolutely phenomenal, Keller, and he's going to have some career in the game.
Absolutely, and I'm sure nobody in Ringmahon Rangers was surprised to see him smash that penalty away, considering he did play a bit of early football out the field. Moving on, there were a couple of other, well, there was a full billing of Premier League fixtures as well. Ruby, I want to pose a question to you. We have a tweet in here from Michael Ryan, who says, I thought Ruby's favourite moment of the weekend would have been Watford's performance at Old Trafford. I can remember him singing Watford's praises 2 years ago against Liverpool. But God bless your memory, Michael Ryan. Ruby, why wasn't that your highlight?
I'd say Michael's fair chance Michael's a Liverpool fan, and I'd say right at this moment in time Everton are looking for an apology from the VAR over their lack of their penalty decision. I'd say Michael wants those points taken away from them. But how many chances can you squander in a game? About 15, looking at Manchester United the other day. But Fergal, you said the referee got it spot on in the cup final yesterday with the VAR calls. What about the Rodri call in the Everton Man City game?
This is another example that we've seen this season in terms of constantly being wafted around of the new interpretation of the handball ruling. And Paul Tierney was the latest one to fall foul of it at Goodison Park this weekend. For me, this is pretty basic. I always think when you look at it in real time, you look at it in slow-mo, you look at it in a still image, if it's a handball in all three of those, it's a handball. I do think sometimes with tackles or with handballs, when it does get slowed down, it can distort what actually went on. In all three of those instances, that is a penalty. His hand or his arm is in an unnatural position, and it catches him on the arm. And Everton were absolutely livid. Frank Lampard and Ashley Cole were on the pitch at the end of the game, remonstrating with Paul Tierney, because this is massive. I mean, so much of this gets framed in the context of Manchester City and how the win keeps them on track, keeps them with a bit of breathing space in front of Liverpool. But results like that could send Everton down. Like, they were on course for getting a really important point against the defending champions. They lost it. They slipped up because of this decision. And I think, ultimately, in terms of an apology, they might even get an apology. There might even be Paul Tierney taken out of the firing line for a couple of weeks in terms of Premier League refereeing. But ultimately, that doesn't turn back the clock for Lampard and for Everton. It was a nailed-on penalty for me. And I think, unfortunately, the handball rule is going to get revisited again ahead of next season, which is going to lead to yet more confusion. Instead of just adopting a bit of common sense in these situations, someone pointed out to me that this idea of anything above the shirt sleeve line is now kind of in this kind of situation of a bit of corridor of uncertainty. Well, Manchester City have got a sponsor on their shirt sleeve, and it doesn't even touch that. Now, that surely should be an indication for Tierney and for VAR, and it just wasn't. And that was why Everton effectively were done over in terms of a decision. And this could be massive for Everton. They're right down in the bottom. If Burnley win against Tottenham tomorrow night, they'll leapfrog them. And then they're in the bottom three with, I think, 12, 13 games to go. And that just makes it even harder for Lampard.
Ruby, it was absolutely disgraceful. I was watching the match Saturday evening with my dad, and within seconds, it only took one replay, and we could tell. Fergal obviously mentioned Paul Tierney there being the referee, but why it even went up to Chris Kavanagh, and ultimately he got the decision wrong, because between the two of them, he was the one giving him the advice, or whether saying go and have a look at it on the monitor, which he should have done as well. It didn't even need to go up to Chris Kavanagh. The one thing that amazes me in these situations, and we all played sport at whatever level we played at, but the one thing that amazes me is that you can nearly tell by the players, by their reaction, or else you look at the fans behind the goal, and I know everyone would say fans can be biased. The Everton fans knew straight away that were behind that goal where Rodri's arm was, and he put his arm out to obviously handle the ball. It was absolutely disgraceful. How they got it so wrong, I'll never know. And it's just total incompetence between the two of them. Why it even went up to Chris Kavanagh, it's just absolutely shocking. And whatever about, obviously, Everton and the trouble they'll find themselves in, the apology is a nonsense. Why they would want an apology, like, that's not going to achieve anything whatsoever. So that's a complete nonsense. But in terms of the title race as well and what it would have meant for Liverpool, it was a disgraceful decision.
And you talk about reactions. I'm not sure which City defender was next in line.
Diaz, he
even gave it away that it was a penalty. You could see the disgust in him as he pointed to the line. But look, we've got to have to go to Old Trafford as well. Come on, Alan, how many chances did they need? Bruno missed three, Ronaldo missed three, Elanga could have scored. Oh my God.
Yeah, it was terrible, yeah. And look, I said it here last week, I think Fergal said that United will still finish fourth. I think Ruby, you were saying third. I'm not sure at all. I don't know how long I've been saying, they're just not good enough. You look at them in the Champions League game the other night as well, against Atletico Madrid. They're just way off the pace where they need to be. And Arsenal, to be fair, in a decent bit of form. Spurs had a good win at the weekend. West Ham winning. And I know United are still there at the moment, but I can't see them finishing fourth.
Unfortunately, time is getting away from us. But Fergal, just before we do move the conversation on to other sports, Bielsa gone from Leeds. It looks like Jesse Marsh is next in line to be taking over. I know some commentary, perhaps lazy commentary, have been calling for Big Sam to get back in there. But it looks like Jesse Marsh is going to go in. But unfortunate to see Bielsa leave in those circumstances.
Yeah, it is. I mean, he's an icon for Leeds United fans. He's absolutely beloved. If you look at situations of teams in relegation battles this season, Steve Bruce, Rafa Benitez, the majority of fans couldn't wait for them to be shown the door. That's just not the case with Bielsa. This was done through gritted teeth. The club essentially think that this is the best way to go. 12 games from home, a fresh face is what they need to change things, to keep them up. But his legacy at Leeds is absolutely enormous in terms of getting them back to the Premier League. And just his kind of stories of him kind of bodding around Leeds and doing nice things, particularly during COVID, he really endeared himself to not just Leeds United fans, but people that live in Leeds. If Jesse Marsh comes in, he's got a big job on his hands, massive amount of pressure because they're in trouble, like a number of teams down the bottom of the table. But I think I speak for everyone when I say, please not Sam Allardyce. I don't want to see Sam Allardyce back in the Premier League. But I don't think Leeds will make that call. It seems like it's going to be Marsh, and I don't think anyone would be desperate enough, although this could be famous last words, to go for Sam Allardyce.
Yeah, I think Leeds are a bit...
I have no sympathy for Bielsa whatsoever. None whatsoever. He could have changed this himself. They've conceded 20 goals in a month. His approach is absolute lunacy. I know what he did when he came in first. It was amazing getting them up to the Premier League. But he could have changed all this himself, Shane. They're conceding goals left, right and centre, and he never did anything about it. His approach was absolute crazy stuff.
There's Alan Cawley. There was nothing better than getting rid of a manager. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, now Bielsa. Fergal Brennan, thanks a million. We're going to take a quick break.
RTE 2FM.
Game on.
On 2FM with Green Farm. Rise and grind and the hustle mindset aren't real. The protein in our chicken and turkey is. Get real with Green Farm. Real protein, real tasty.
Hello, just as our computer crashes, you're very welcome back to Game On this Monday evening. It is great to have your company wherever you are tuning in from. Murray Kinsel is still live in studio. I'm Shane Dawson and Ruby Walsh is live as well. Alan Cawley he's out the gap. He's off the Daily Mount Park because there is a full billing of League of Ireland fixtures this evening. Bo's Pats in a big Dublin derby. Pats obviously looking to redeem themselves after the loss of Sligo on Friday. Bo's frustrated by a resilient Dundalk side, so Keith Long will be hoping for a win there. Derry, big win last Friday against Rovers in the last minute. Sligo obviously coming off the back of a win on Friday as well. So it's Derry Sligo up in the Ryan McBride Brandywell. Dundalk versus Finn Harps. Dundalk looking to get their first win after 2-2-2s. And there is another Dublin derby. It's UCD versus Shelburne, which personally I cannot wait for that one. Shell's first win of the season against Drogheda last week. So another key battle in terms of staying up. Of course, Shell's newly promoted. And indeed, Shamrock Rovers versus Drogheda out in Talla Stadium. Rovers hurting from that trip to the Brandywell. Expect a tough challenge now for Kevin Doherty and Drogheda, certainly will, and perhaps might feel a bit of a backlash against Drogheda this evening. Coming up a bit later on, we'll have Gaelic football with Barry Cahill. A couple of texts in as to why there is no hurling this evening. Well, the reason for that is we'll have Niall Moran on tomorrow and we'll be devoting a large chunk of the show to that. But we turn our attention now to rugby. And as I mentioned earlier, Murray Kinsler is in studio. Murray, we touched on the Ireland match briefly at the start of the show, and I suppose it was the result we would have wanted, but it's been overshadowed by the red cards, the sending off and the rulings. To the casual listener, to the casual viewer, I suppose, if you could explain the rationale as to why Italy were down to, I suppose, 13 men at one stage. I suppose the rulings around it.
Yeah, so Italy's starting hooker, the guy in the middle of the front row, got injured early in the game. He got replaced. His replacement got sent off, so he's off the pitch. They're down to 14. Then they didn't have anyone to scrummage in the hooker position in the front row. None of their props were comfortable. And before the match, you have to indicate this on your team sheet, whether someone's happy to slot in there. Italy didn't have that. And so the laws of the game state that they had to remove an extra player when the game goes to uncontested scrums. It's definitely a little known law. And everyone on the pitch, apart from the referee, in fairness to him, Nika Amashukeli, the Georgian on his Six Nations debut, he was about the only one who knew this quirk of law that meant, yeah, Italy had to play the rest of game without 13. And there you go, instantly in the 19th minute, any chance, an outside chance really, of a contest of Italy putting it up to Ireland is gone, and everyone really loses out. Ireland didn't get the prep they wanted for Twickenham in 2 weeks. Italy didn't get a chance to actually put it up to Ireland, and the fans in the stadium didn't get the kind of spectacle that they wanted. So I'd be shocked if there's not a tweak to the law. And listen, they're trying to protect against teams manipulating numbers. In the past, we've had teams probably feign injuries just to get uncontested scrums when they've been pummeled at scrum time. And obviously, you never want to get in a situation where someone who's not, I suppose, qualified and comfortable with scrummaging and hooker is put in that dangerous position. But it was just really unfair in Italy.
Rules are rules, but the law can be an ass at times, and it most certainly was on Saturday. Leaving that aside, Murray, Ireland started brightly. Joey Carberry scored when Ireland did, or Italy even, did have a full complement on the pitch. But what did you make of them all in all? Was it a good performance, or is it just too hard to judge?
It was a frustrating one from their point of view, and it really was weird atmosphere afterwards, because they'd obviously racked up a big score. They've kept themselves in the Six Nations hunt, but they didn't go about performing the way they probably have in the recent months. And you think back to November, they probably got a bit intoxicated by the thought of how much space there was going to be on the pitch. Teams always get giddy, even with just one player off the pitch when there's a red card. And when you think you're against 13, you probably go away from the simple principles that allow you to actually exploit that space. Ireland probably ran across the pitch a little bit. They probably pushed passes a little bit too often, rather than timing their opportunity to go wide perfectly, and they just weren't as clinical and accurate as we've seen them in the past. There's probably, on the player's point of view, just that little bit of energy going out of it, like everyone else in the stadium, from the 19th minute. So yeah, there was disappointment in the kind of collective performance, but at the same time there were some nice passages in attack. You mentioned that Carberry try when Italy were at 15. It was a brilliant bit of play where the forwards and backs interplay and link with their passing skills, and even later in the game you saw the likes of Ryan Baird getting his try on his first Six Nations start, a brilliant block down, lovely pick up, and he had a good performance in the game. Dan Sheehan was really good on his first start for Ireland, and as we mentioned earlier on, Mike Lowry making his Ireland debut at fullback with two tries, and probably could have had a third, but he generously passed on to James Lowe for Lowe's second. He was back after that hamstring injury that ruled him out of the first two rounds, and he was really lively as well. So there's bits in there certainly for Ireland to take away.
If you're Andy Farrell and you're watching Michael Lowry not maybe taking his third try and passing, are you thinking, yeah, there's a team player, or there's a guy that could have more killer instinct?
I think you're thinking that he's a team player, and he's probably doing the smarter thing there, because you dart for that line, and he's quick, I know, but there is a covering defender, and if you get held up in that situation, it's probably embarrassing. And in a bigger game, it's a key moment. He backs his passing skill, and he knows that Lowe is a sharp finisher from there. So for me, probably the right decision there.
In terms of individual performances, and I include Michael Lowry in it, I suppose Craig Casey coming on, Treadwell in the second row, the argument of Joey over Johnny, etc. Have any of the, I suppose, for want of a better word, fringe players done enough in that performance to perhaps be in a match day squad for England in a couple of weeks?
Not just on that performance alone. I don't think you can judge it that highly, but the guys we've seen lots of before, someone like Dan Sheehan, he built on that. Ryan Baird, we've seen his athleticism, his dynamism in contact, he built on that absolutely. The out-half one is really interesting, because Johnny Sexton comes off the bench, and it's great for Ireland obviously to have their captain back. He looked really physically sharp, he looked really hungry, and he had some excellent touches on the ball. He squared it all up, as in they got running straight or getting upfield. He brought his teammates into the game really well, and that wasn't always the case. It was excellent for Joey Carberry obviously to get another big start, a second consecutive start for Ireland, when there just haven't been those opportunities through both injury and non-selection, I suppose, when Sexton's been in the team. But I think you saw again that Johnny Sexton remains the main man in this team.
And what about at 12? Robbie Henshaw plays way back into the team, or will Bundy Aki be expecting to line out in Twickenham?
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating selection. It always is with those centres. I'd say Bundyaki is in the kind of favourite seat there. It'll be fascinating to see if England are able to get Manu Tuilagi back on the pitch. He was obviously supposed to play for England against Wales last weekend. Another late injury for him, and he's been absolutely blighted by that in his career. But we can remember any time he plays against Ireland, he is absolutely pivotal for England. He's really good at getting over the gain line. Irish defences have long struggled with just stopping him before he can batter over the top, and he's really the kind of symbol of some of those big England wins over Ireland, so they'll be desperate to get him back in the team. If he's there, you do look at Bundyaki as a guy who can go head to head with him, and Aki has teamed up well with Ringrose in midfield. It's a nice luxury to have, but I think given what we've seen from Aki in the last few months, he's been probably pushed for that start.
There are all decisions and calls that will be made in the next probably 10 days, Murray, but what about the opposition? England beat Wales. Eddie Jones is probably pumped up. They'll be tough opposition.
They will, and I have a feeling they're going to produce their best of the championship for Ireland, but they haven't been perfect so far. They're in a strange spot where they're trying to transition away from some experienced players, and Marcus Smith is obviously now the kind of heartbeat of the team. The 23-year-old young out half, he's been brilliant with Harlequins. He's a different sort of player. He's very instinctive. He's got great attacking flair. He can beat defenders. Himself and Alex Dombrandt, his Harlequins teammate, they've come into the team and they're fresher faces, and England now are moving to a different model of attack. It's been a little bit muddled at times, but you can see the nice moments in there. And when you've got a team with the likes of Marwa Toje just absolutely wrecking opposition ball, both legally and illegally, in fairness to him, he treads that line very well and gets away with a lot of stuff. You're always going to be in with a shout. They're really good athletes, England, at home in Twickenham with a massive crowd. It's going to be a really big challenge for this Ireland team, but it feels like this is a good time to get England when they're trying to find their own feet with a new style of play and some new figures in the team.
Just on Marcus Smith, because Josh van der Flair was man of the match against Italy, and he mentioned that Ireland could have been a bit more disciplined and a bit more clinical at the breakdown. We saw Marcus Smith kick six penalties against Wales and guide them to victory as well. And similar to the analogy I was saying about Creevan Kelleher, he looked really experienced for such a young man that you mentioned there. How do you nullify Marcus Smith? And I know, I suppose the obvious way is don't give away penalties that can be kicked over and you stopped a couple of 3 points going. But in terms of from open play as well, how do you stop that threat?
Yeah, you've got to work really well in your kind of trio of defenders. Either side of him, you've got to be really alert, because he's brilliant at isolating and getting one-on-one, and he's got this amazing little goose step where he just hitches and re-accelerates, and before you know it, he's just darted past you. So really connected defensively is key for him. England are starting to use him out the kind of back of their forward pods, that second wave of attack, and again, he's looking to isolate defenders and bring his offloading into it. So Ireland will look to apply the kind of pressure that he hasn't really faced in Test rugby yet so far, but he is a really excellent player and a really strong personality, a little bit like Sexton. I think they're different players obviously, but they're unbelievably ambitious and driven.
And Murray, quickly before we let you go, France forced Scotland into all the errors that they nearly forced Ireland into. The Grand Slam is theirs for the taking, isn't it?
Yeah, they're looking really good. All areas of the game, like, they have some lethal attacking passages, some brilliant individuals like Antoine Dupont, and really the list goes on there. But they're really good at all the other stuff that's a bit more boring. The kicking, the defending, the breakdown. They're just really complete at the moment with excellent depth across the squad as well, and it is ominous form. Listen, they've got to go to Wales and play against a proud Welsh team in Cardiff. That's never an easy task, and England at home on the final day, but the way they're tracking, they are looking very good for that, and probably for the 2023 World Cup as well on home soil. They'll be really pleased with where they are. But Ireland, yeah, we've got to I suppose hope that someone else does a favour and brings open that title race again.
Probably unfair, Murray, my last question, to constrict you to a word, but in a word, can France be stopped?
No.
No, okay, there. Concise, yeah. Listen, Murray Kinsley, thank you very much. We'll have you on again to be previewing No Six Nations action this weekend, but indeed there is some the following weekend, and obviously England-Ireland, the big one as well. Just briefly before we do go, just important to mention, Ireland have been handed an unexpected entry into 2021 Wheelchair Rugby League World Cup, which will be held in England later this year. The side had missed out on qualifying for the tournament, originally due to take place in November last year, but postponed due to COVID-19 issues. Ireland will take the place of Norway, who have been forced to withdraw to the preparations being disrupted by the pandemic. And also, I think a mention has to go to Railway Union retaining their AIL title, defeating BlackRock 24-18 in a very entertaining final. Eve Higgins delivering a player of the match performance there to spur her side on to victory. So many congratulations to Railway Union. Murray Kinsler, thank you very much. Up next is Gaelic football, and we'll have Barry Cowell live.
RTE 2FM. Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Get real with Green Farm's chicken and turkey range. Real protein, real tasty.
Game on.
Gaelic football.
Welcome back to Game On, where we are going to discuss Gaelic football. We're a little bit over halfway through the Allianz Leagues, and Barry Cowell joins us on the line. Barry, I doubt you thought you'd be coming on the show to talk about Dublin losing four in a row. And as a Kildare man, I'm most certainly going to start there. Great day for the Lee Whites in Newbridge, but what about Desi Farrell's men?
Yeah, true, Ruby. I didn't know whether to take the call this evening or not on the back of yesterday's results. But look, it was a really big win for Kildare, a very significant win for this group of players, and obviously for the new management team as well. That type of win will really, bring them to another level in terms of, you know, the ideas that the management team are bringing to the squad. You know, two home games now in Newbridge against Kerry and Dublin, and after picking up 3 points. But I think the fact that, you know, a Leinster team and a Leinster contender has beaten Dublin, it is a significant win for that group of players. You know, they've suffered a lot to Dublin over the last 10, 12 years. Hadn't got a meaningful win over Dublin since probably 2000. Beyond 20 years. So, it was obviously great scenes for Kildare people yesterday in Newbridge, and certainly a win that they deserved.
Most of the lads standing on the sideline were on the pitch the last time Kildare beat Dublin, but it was magical to see. But Barry, looking at Dublin, and they are some of the giants of Gaelic football, just to watch big players in that Dublin team miss goal chances, did that set alarm bells ringing in your head?
Yeah, I think at certain times during the match yesterday, Ruby, actually, you know, Dublin were going quite well, and they certainly could have got something out of the game if they had been a lot more clinical up front. And it is unusual to see some of these key players, you know, multiple All-Star, multiple All-Ireland winners, you know, miss these chances either for points or for goals. They probably left about 3-5 out on the pitch yesterday. You know, the positive is that they created the chances, but certainly it has been a bit of a pattern over the last 3 or 4 games that they haven't been as clinical as we expect. And now, obviously, they have had ridiculously high standards over the last sort of 7, 8, 9 years. But, you know, it is probably a bit of a concern for Desi Farrell and the management team that they aren't converting these chances. And it's not really the new guys that are missing them. It's the more seasoned guys that haven't been that clinical, and maybe trying to overplay the ball a little bit and not taking on responsibility themselves. But I'm sure it's something that they'll be keen to address now and in 2 weeks' time when that run of 3 league games start up again.
Just very briefly, Barry, before we move on to the other Division 1 fixtures, I mean, this is Dublin's 4th consecutive league defeat for the first time since 1972. It's Kildare's first victory, obviously, since 2000, I think it was, 22 years ago. So, listen, Colm Cooper was on League Sunday last night, and he mentioned that Kerry in 2013 lost 4 consecutive league matches, but then had an all right summer. They had 2 All-Stars, I think it was Gooch himself and James O'Donoghue, and they went on to a semi-final of the championship. Yeah. So is it too early to be pressing the panic button just yet?
I think it is, to be honest, Shane. I mean, when we get into the heat of the championship into May, you know, around Leinster final time, end of May, I think a lot of what happened in January and February time is usually forgotten about. That's just the nature of it. But I think with Dublin, like, they've so many players to still come back. I mean, I think Dublin are a different outfit when you have the likes of Paddy Small, Cormac Costello, Conor Callaghan into the forward line. And even, you know, all going well and these two teams, you know, play to form come the championship time, you're looking at a Dublin Kildare, you know, possible Leinster final at the end of May. That game in Croke Park will be very different than what took place, I think, at the end of February in Newbridge. So, you know, I don't think it's overly alarming in that sense. But certainly the fact that Dublin lost yesterday, I think it was a key game for them to win in order to avoid relegation. And it's certainly an uphill task because you're looking at minimum 5 points you need to probably stay up in Division 1. And now they obviously have 3 games left, and they probably need to win all 3 of them to stay up. So it won't be ideal preparation going into the Leinster Championship. But, you know, I still would be confident enough that come May time, when they get a lot of the key players back, that they'll still be very much a contender for the All-Ireland later in the summer.
Oh, I'm sure they will raise their heads yet, but moving away from Newbridge and across the Shannon to the west, Mayo made five changes from the team that beat Dublin and they were still too good for Armagh. James Horan described them as sluggish in the beginning, but they most certainly found a way of winning.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, very impressed with Mayo over the last few weeks. They usually have a bit of a roller coaster Alliance League campaign year on year, but they've been very consistent this year. And the beauty about it is that they still have a lot of good players still to come back into the team. James Horan, it seems, have, you know, brought in new players and seamlessly brought into the team, and it's been working very well for them. They obviously got a big boost with the Dublin win last week. You know, at certain times yesterday, looked at Armagh were going to win that game in Roscommon. They were 3 points up with about 10 minutes to go, but Mayo finished very strongly. They scored the last 5 points in that game. You know, guys coming off the bench like Aidan O'Shea and Kevin McLaughlin certainly did the business. But, you know, I think things are looking very healthy for Mayo at the moment. They seem to be building a squad of, you know, 25 really top-class footballers, which is something that you are going to need once you get out of your province and head into like an All-Ireland quarter-final, semi-final stage. You need all those options as a manager, and I think things are looking very good for them at the moment, certainly.
I think that always goes back to that perennial kind of question of trying to find a balance between blooding new guys through and indeed getting results on the board. And Mayo travel to Kerry when the league resumes in 2 weeks, while Armagh will welcome Kildare. And I think it's, you know, we have to give credit to Kildare as well. It wasn't just Dublin being poor. Kildare fully deserved of the win in Newbridge. But Mayo's opponents will be Kerry. They had a handy enough win up in Inishkeen over Monaghan. And I suppose, again, when you're looking at big names, David Clifford, Sean O'Shea racking up a combined total of 3-5. You mentioned that Dublin kicked away 3-5 and I suppose they left those scores behind them, but Kerry on the other hand, they seem to be ticking over quite nicely at the moment.
Yeah, they really have improved week on week over the last month, and I think the thing with Kerry, like, their forwards are such class operators, and you know they're going to rack up high scores at any stage. But I think yesterday what Monaghan did, they were sort of architects of their own downfall in terms of how they played. You know, Rory Began coming out and giving those couple of turnovers. It's hard enough to stop a Kerry forward line of Sean O'Shea and the two Cliffords, etc., on a good day. But if you're not at your best, you know, Kerry really will embarrass you and put a high score up. And I think yesterday was a big win for them because traditionally they have struggled going up to Monaghan, particularly in that pitch and in a scheme. It's usually been a fruitless trip for them and a long trip home back to Kerry. But I'm sure it was very satisfying them yesterday as they got on the bus to head home because, you know, they mixed that sort of class up front with a lot of steel around the middle third. They turned Monaghan over numerous times, particularly in the first half, and you know, we're probably 15-16 points up at some stage, which is a very high score to rack up. In fairness to Monaghan, they still stuck at it. I mean, in Division 1, if you're not on it and you're not tuned in, because it's of such a high standard, there is a chance that you can be embarrassed. Now, they did stick with it for those last 10 or 15 minutes and brought it back to 7 or 8 points, which is a credit to them. But, you know, I think at the moment, certainly Kerry would be the form team, with Mayo very, very close behind them.
And Barry, I'm afraid we've run out of time, so I'll have to apologise to any listeners we have in Donegal that we didn't get to them. But Declan Bonner did say a lot of young players have come of age, and they most certainly had. Barry, thanks for taking our call. We'll be back tomorrow night with Mark Langdon on European football. We'll have to mention Shane Lowry in the golf, and Niall Horan, who was on management duty tonight, will be here to discuss hurling. Tara Kumar's up next.
RTE
2FM.
On
2FM with Green Farm. Being up to 90 isn't real. The protein in our range is. Get real with Green Farm. Real protein, real tasty.